You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, we continue our 8-episode miniseries on Netflix's Hip Hop Evolution documentary. Nate is joined by Alexi Auld and Eugene S. Robinson, his cohorts from the YouTube show If the Shoes Fit. This week, they discuss the 4th episode of Hip Hop Evolution, The Birth of Gangsta Rap, which takes us from Schoolie D in Philly to Ice-T, Eazy-E, and N.W.A. in Los Angeles. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and once again, I'm joined by my colleagues, Alexi Auld and Eugene S. Robinson, for our appreciation of Netflix's Hip Hop Evolution. We're on episode 4, part 1, The Birth of Gangsta Rap. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So now we're...
Perfect timing, actually.
Indeed. It's always time for gangsta rap, Eugene. Always time for gangsta rap. So they've covered... I felt like they jumped to this one a tad early. But
yeah, they did.
As big as, you know, a chronology as they're covering, I can see why they wanted to get to this. I see why they wanted to get to this in the first season, because obviously Dre and Snoop Dogg, as big as, you know, Run DMC and the Beastie Boys and everybody were, Dre and Snoop Dogg were multi-platinum.
And all you have to do with Dre is say billionaire and you could just stop, period. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And but we start out in LA when it was a backwater, when it was not hip to hip hop. Although, you know, they're saying it wasn't hip hop, but it was hip hop. It was just a style of hip hop that was
corny.
Yeah, it was electro, it was techno, it was planet rock, which was popular in New York, you know, for what, 2-3 years. And LA kept it going for 5, 6, 7 years beyond that.
Well, mostly because of the dancing, which you could do on like the Venice Boardwalk, the popping and the locking and stuff like that, which is popular in, you know, before it, that was a spear point for hip hop in LA, I'd say. I mean, that's what they say. Ice-T was a dancer before he was anything, right?
Yep. And Dre and DJ Yella, later to be in NWA, were part of the World Class Wrecking Crew, which was all into the techno electro type stuff. And Ice-T, they don't go into this in the show, but Ice-T had numerous electro singles. If you can dig them up, they're about as funny looking as him in the pastels and the ponytail.
Which is why it was great when Charlie Murphy put them on blast on the True Stories and the Chappelle Show. And he goes, "You guys in LA trying to act hard now, but back in the 80s, we remember." And they, you know, which of course, during some of the numerous beefs, I remember somebody put up a photograph of Dre.
It was Easy. Easy-E did it. Yeah.
Easy-E, and the silver suit. And the
talk about and a stuff. G thing. Used to be a she thing. Yeah. Corny ass.
which makes me think of Ready for the World. I wonder
what. Oh, Sheila.
I love those guys. Yeah.
The classic stuff. Classic stuff. But let's stay on focus. Let's stay on topic. So until Ice-T released 6 in the Morning, LA is this backwater into the techno and electro stuff that's, you know, passe and corny in New York. But Ice-T properly recognizes, like, they start with Ice-T, and I understand why they did it, because it's about gangster rap, so you expect it to be about LA. You got to focus on LA. That's the nexus of the story. But Ice-T points out that the first gangster rapper was Philly's Schoolie D, who's one of my personal favorites. I got to see Schoolie D with a live band in Austin, Texas in 88, and it totally blew me away. He was opening up for Fishbone, and then Tim Kerr had a band, a funk band at the time.
Yeah,
the Goose.
Yep.
You know Tim Kerr, and like all Tim Kerr bands, he was in the Big Boys and Poison 13, a number great live. And Bad Mother Goose was terrible on record, but it was an incredible show live. And School of D with the live band was killing it. And so they go to Philly and interview him. And I thought it was funny that he would only agree to interview him if the dude brought him a cake. And he did.
It's a man after my own heart, man. You get baked goods. Some guys say, usually, could you put me on the guest list? I go, yeah, but what do I get out of it? And the guy says, I'll tell you what, man, I'll make you some cinnamon rolls. And I said, all right, if you don't have the cinnamon rolls, I'm going to punch you in the mouth. I'm not going to let you in. And so he calls. Somebody says, hey, there's a guy. His name Oliver at the front door for you. I said, where are they? And the guy goes, right here. Bro. And he takes the thing off. And they were like, great. Of course, I didn't eat them because I was completely paranoid that he's going to poison me.
There you go. Like Michael Jordan before the Utah Jazz game. Do you see that in The Last Dance?
I haven't seen that.
So the flu game, instead of having the flu, it was food poisoning, allegedly. Ordered from the only pizza place that was open.
Yeah. Fatal mistake, near fatal mistake, but Jordan came back. But Schoolie D, jaded showbiz veteran, only does the interview if he gets some cake. And my favorite, I want to, before we get to Schoolie D, though, there was a quote from Arabian Prince that I thought was telling, that Uncle Jam had already moved up and they were doing like sports arenas and the convention center, 5,000-10,000 people, no MCs, only DJs. So people were coming just to see the DJs perform. And they got the guy from Cypress Hill, who's pointing out, you know, the kids would be waiting for those shows and then freaking out over, you know, what they were playing, what records they were playing. And there would be pop locking and battling, rap battling to it afterwards. So the scene wasn't total. I mean, to me, if like you're getting 10,000 people at the Coliseum to see DJs, you've got a hip hop scene, even if it is a little bit corny.
But it seemed like it seemed to go back. I mean, just that when you talk about just the DJ scene, it reminded me of the earlier episodes of Hip Hop Evolution where they were starting in New York, right? When Grandmaster Flash was just a DJ playing, you know? So
yeah,
they were a little behind in that way, I guess.
Yeah, but everybody's got to go through evolution, and you know, no shortcuts.
Evolution.
Exactly. But back to the gangster beginning. So Schoolie D.
I have to say, with Schoolie D, I still maintain a New Yorker's contempt, kind of unspoken, but just a barely kind of subcutaneous contempt for Schoolie D, just because fashion-wise, I just thought, he's Philly guy. The guy, you know, I just wasn't. So I had to separate him. I couldn't look at him while I was listening to the music. I just had to do it because I didn't like his style. And as far as I was concerned, he wasn't the first hard guy out there. There were other hard guys out there, you know. But all of a sudden, everybody was talking about Schoolie D. So all right, you know.
On the PSK stuff, the first single?
Yeah.
Saturday Night.
Parkside Killers. Yeah.
Because his second, third album got nowhere. Like when I saw him live, I was totally astonished, loved him, ran out and bought the only vinyl I could find, which was his third album, Am I Black Enough for You, which nobody liked. Nobody paid any attention to that thing. And I wore that out. And then later I got all the Saturday Night and with all the PSK and all that stuff. But the School of D story I liked was when he talks about how they go to the studio to record PSK, they're stoned out of their minds. And he just puts the reverb on it until the speakers there in the studio, the engineer's like, you're going to get me fired, bro. You're going to get me fired. Like, no, fuck that. Let's tape it like this. And the next morning he listens to it and he's like, Jesus, what was I thinking with the reverb? And he's headed to the studio to go change it. And his homies have made copies and passed around the neighborhood, and people are giving him ovations walking out the door. And then they tell him if he changed it, he was like, man, I was about to go change it. We'll shoot you if you change it.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, but then they switch back to Ice-T, who admits, and you got to give him points for just fessing up to it, he totally swiped the cadence for PSK.
Yeah, of course. Morning, he would have been a fool not to. Come on. The other side, it was like, who's a Pharrell trying to say they didn't rob him and Robin Thicke didn't rob Marvin Gaye? Are you kidding? Yeah. Are you kidding?
Well, again, that's
get out of here. Man.
He used to go out and party.
The melodies and the chords are totally different. I mean, that's it. They still feel of the song, which is not stealing.
Well, one thing that's interesting is apparently, even though he was giving credit to School ED, they didn't have in this interview what they had in other interviews, where he talks about 6 a.m. and Criminal Minded hitting at the same time or around the same time. So, you know, in terms of just expanding, you know, giving credit where credit is due, you know, I thought it was interesting that he didn't, that in this interview, either they didn't include it or whatever, like they didn't talk about BDP around the same time engaging in, which would make it even more interesting in like what you were saying, Eugene, with regards to like, you know, School ED wasn't the first, but then again, at least with the Ice-T and the 6 a.m, he definitely wasn't, you know.
Second. MC Light.
Sorry,
that was a name I was trying to remember from 3 shows ago. Sorry.
Well, sorry. We brought it. We got to cover this stuff. But the other quote, the Ice-T quote, that I thought was interesting was if you get yourself connected to players, the world flips backwards. Doing what's right is for suckers, and you're living in a world with all these villains, fiends, and scandals, and you take pride in that. The world actually becomes backwards. And that's pretty classic. That makes me think of like William Burroughs and the whole underground, you know, hobo jungle, the argot of thieves and all that stuff that, you know, is American.
Jean Genet.
Yeah, French and American literary tradition. But I think the hip-hop guys, because they blew up so big and because the violence in LA in the 80s and all over the country in the early 90s was so bad, it's going to come back and blow up in everybody's faces in a few episodes or in a couple seasons. But for now, it's artistic success. Another thing that Ice-T said was, you know, he realized when he started getting into hip hop that he wasn't just going to live the game. I've got to document the game. And that, you know, is the whole redemptive power of art thing. But is that just bullshit, or is that
the thing is, you can't tell the story, and I'm glad they don't try to. You can't tell the story without essentially talking about crack, right? And and you know, the Crips and the Bloods were formed specifically to people were realizing when they went to outlying African American folks were realizing when they went to outlying beach communities, which were full of Okies, that they were getting beaten up. You know, it wasn't like you had a bunch of cats from Compton who were trying to surf. You just wanted to go to the beach. And so in the 60s, they were getting their asses kicked. They said, okay, we're going to form a group to protect ourselves from these, dirty white boys. And that's how they started. It wouldn't have ended up being this murderous cult had not been for a profit motive, which was introduced by Freeway Ricky, CIA-funded, cheap cocaine turned into crack. Never would have happened, which of course destroyed the rest of the country and made us all, you know, weaker, meaner, and really devastated lots large portions of African American music up to and including today, because a lot of these people who were croaking, a friend of mine's sister had a drug problem back in the day, so, you know, permanent immunosuppressed and so on. So but without that, these would just been gangs. So it wasn't the music. The music was just a kind of a harbinger in my mind, you know, to a much more serious issue. They could chase hip hop guys. And I watched a little bit ahead. Sorry, the Southern way. They could chase hip hop guys. But the reality of it was that wasn't the seed. That wasn't the problem. And it wasn't until kids in the suburbs started getting high on crack and Ryan Gosling was playing a crack addicted teacher in whatever movie that was, that people start saying, oh, it's not a problem. It's a problem now. Problem.
Yeah, once the opioids hit the hillbillies, you know, people started to care a little bit. But back to our story. So from there, then they segue to NWA, and you've got these guys. You know, you've got Dr. Dre and DJ Yella, who had been in the World Class Wrecking Crew doing the techno stuff, and Arabian Prince, who's been a producer on the scene. And they're hanging out, and they're frustrated. They're hearing what Ice-T's done, and they're frustrated with, frankly, not making that much money off the records they've been making. And they're thinking about doing something new, and they're hanging out with this guy Eazy-E, who's a gangster. You know, Arabian Prince calls him this little Napoleon, little dictator motherfucker, and, you know, is straight up crazy and scary, real street dude. And he's got the money, and he wants to put it up to fund this new project they've got. And they know Ice Cube, and they know he's a talented lyricist. Easy's tight with MC Ren, who's a semi-talented.
Hey, he has some good lines. REM sells Ren, but I'm wrong.
No. I love Ren, but come on.
No.
He uses the word villain in every rhyme scheme.
That's true.
He is the unsung. He's gotten short shrift in everything. The guy is. There are a lot worse people who are advanced a lot further than this cat. I like MC Ren. I think he's gotten the movie shit on him, and everybody's like, he's like the Larry Fine of hip hop.
Well, it's just by comparison with Ice Cube and Dr. Dre, and you know, with their
Dre is not writing shit, it's Ice Cube. That's it.
Well, Dre's the one doing the beats and the sounds,
and that's
an essential part of this recipe. But the other thing was, it was also Dre's idea to make Eazy-E a rapper. And Arabian Prince tells that story, you know, that Ice Cube has written Boys in the Hood, wrote it in 11th grade. And Dre convinces Eazy to record it. And Eazy's got this great voice, although he can't rap. And so they baby step him through recording this thing, punching
line
in.
Line by line.
Although I was just reading today in a book about Rakim, he also frequently punched his raps in line by line. So even the great ones have to do that sometimes. And so Eazy, obviously, Boys in the Hood blows up. They put together the NWA and the Posse album, and which is a weird album. I mean, it's got some stuff from the DOC and his crew out in Texas, and then Arabian Prince stuff that is just totally didn't fit, you know. And I remember when NWA hit, like in my hometown, NWA was the first group that all the white boys loved. I mean, it just blew up like nothing I'd ever seen.
But it wasn't like magic. It blew up when they hit MTV, right? That was most people's exposure to NWA.
We didn't even have MTV in my hometown. We got MTV and McDonald's after Moscow did. So the cassettes were just getting passed out, and it was just immediate. It was catnip for the rednecks. You know, we just all went crazy for this shit. You know, and like me and my college boyfriends had been into Run DMC and the BCs and LL Cool J and Public Enemy before that. But NWA was the one that got over with everybody. I mean, it was just massive, massive impact. And that's what they get into with Tipper Gore and the backlash that, you know, this was fine and dandy when it's just black folks. Yeah. The Parents Media Resource Council, you know, nobody cared when it was just the black kids listening to this stuff. But once it's hit in the suburbs, there was a massive freak out. And then they record Fuck the Police, and it's totally off the chain. And I love the quote from, they had the DJ Greg Mack from W Day, which is the big LA hip hop station. He was like, when they came out with that, everybody was like, oh, but then all of us black guys were like, you know what? Fuck the police.
Yeah. But one thing that they sort of maybe kind of touch on, but I can't really emphasize enough, that there were two places in America where I was afraid of the police, and Philly, under Rizzo from the 60s, was not a good place to be if you were a hippie, if you were a punk rocker, cops would straight up pull up on you. And if you looked at them funny, they'd say, what's up, chief? Get out the car and be chest to chest with you on the sidewalk for what would be apparently reckless eyeballing, no reason. And L.A. under Daryl Gates, the pig Daryl Gates. And I don't say that easily. I got family with law enforcement, but Daryl Gates was a pig. And they were bad. They were bad, bad, bad. You know, a steady diet of SWAT and Adam 12 and Dragnet led these guys to think that they were like, they were just, it was something else, something else. So
it's like friends of mine from California were like back in the day, were like, fuck chips, you know, like, because fuck that. Like, that's not what they're like out there. And I was like, no, come on, Eric Estrada. Like, you know, so he's like, Mexican, he's Puerto Rican. I was like, oh, okay.
Nah, yeah. They put a zap on those guys' heads, and those guys were miserable. So to come out with a song like Fuck the Police when it came out, that was, you know, I mean, and they tie it into, you know, April 29th. So, yeah.
Yeah, and they tie it all together. When did you guys first hear any of this stuff, Eugene?
I moved at that. I think I'd have to say 87, and because I had taken the money from Leonard Part 6, the Bill Cosby movie, and I bought my first house in East Palm, which at the time was the murder capital of America because of crack and drug dealing. And so my plan was to buy the most expensive house I could find in the worst area, and so that's what I did, several blocks from here. Now that neighborhood is all completely gentrified, and one of my roommates at the time brought the tape in, and that's, I go, what is that shit you're playing? And that was the first time I heard Straight Outta Compton. He was, you know, he lived in East Palo Alto, he's born and raised. But he was straight up middle class. And I remember in an amusing way, he came out with a record. He goes, man, we're taking a road trip. You want to come with us? I go, where are you going? He said, we're going to Compton. So they pull up at Compton, right? And these are black kids, you know, but they're like a couple of years younger than me. So I was like, I don't know, 26 then. So they were like 20. And they go to Compton and they stop the car in the middle of the street and they run out to the monument that says, Welcome to Compton, and they were shot at. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. Blah, 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 blah. Because they got back in the car and pulled off. It's like, people didn't want to be part of your fucking music video. Fuck you, you know.
And Alexi?
Well, so it's funny because my experiences were a different kind of thing than Eugene. So when I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my parents kept the house, but moved out to the suburbs after drug needles and crack. You know, we were where we lived, the block behind us, Newton Street, was the corridor for the heroin trade for the East Coast. And so, you know, even though I didn't
hold go to, on, hold on, say, how old are you again?
48. God. So, yeah. So, so what happened was when we went out there, so we went out and, I heard the NWA tape because we were going to South Broadway Baptist Church, which was this Native American church with Lumbee Indians who lived in Baltimore to work at the General Motors plant from North Carolina, Lumberton. And so a guy there said, hey, man, check this shit out. And he, in church, like, let me borrow an NWA tape. And I went home and I listened to it. And I was like, the fuck? Like, it was like one of these things, like, scary to listen to. Like, at that time, it was the conscience rap. And then, like, they had, like, gunfire, like, as sound effects, and bitch this, and all this kind of stuff. And, like, you know, it literally was, like, the reactions that people had in Hip Hop Evolution totally was it. Like, what the fuck is this? You know? And so, you know, it just, I didn't gravitate towards it after that, because having grown up in an environment that was ravaged by crack and ravaged by drugs, it wasn't a funny thing to me. It wasn't a fun thing, like knowing people who got murdered, you know, so it wasn't, I did not identify with it. And I didn't listen to it again until my 20s, you know, when I got, my brother got, and I listened to it, I was like, oh shit, this is what people were talking about. You know, and you realize, like, okay, this is why this is adult music. Adult, as an adult, I enjoyed it more than I did as a teenager.
Well, I have to say, and they don't talk about this at all, but I remember this, and I think, Nader, you remember this. So they came out with the record, the first record, and everybody, hipster, well, early versions of hipsters, everybody was completely into Madonna, Sandra Bernhardt. And then they came out with, and they didn't touch on this in the episode at all, their second record, and there was no sophomore slumping, because this was completely rebarbative. All of their, like, lefty, yeah, you know, supporting the cause, listen to the second record, and they were like, we're done. These guys are so deeply damaged that we can't. And I want, and for those of you who haven't listened to the record, the centerpiece and the one that I'm focused on very specifically is a song, To Kill a Hooker, in which they have a skit on the record where they kidnap a prostitute off the sex worker off the street, pull her into the car, and shoot her in the head and dump her body out on the pavement. And that was a point at which, you know, all the kind of lefty fans were like, yeah, these guys are like, you know, they're leading the charge. Yeah, reporters from the front lines, the struggle against the cops in L.A. They were like, okay, these guys are pathologically disturbed and we can't participate. So Madonna was out. Sandra Bernhardt was out. And there was something perverse about the contrarian nature. I didn't see it as self-sabotage because I knew people would stick around.
Well, I asked you to quit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it was... and then, of course, it segued pretty nicely into the Ghetto Boys, you know, some of their stuff that was just aggressively like horror movie-esque, mm-hmm. like horrorcore.
Yep, yep.
Right. So.
Grave Diggers.
Yeah. And so. And to clear up a little confusion, there's Indo and the Posse, which is a compilation album that, to me, that was the first record. That was the first one we got our hands on. It had Eazy-E's version of Boys in the Hood, and it had a couple NWA songs, and then it had some Arabian Prince and some stuff from the DOC, although it wasn't called the DOC. It was whatever his crew was called before that. Then there's Straight Outta Compton, and then there's the one, I'm not even going to say the title.
EFL, there's a bunch of them. Just do the backwards.
Evil's Nagging.
Yeah. And that one, I mean, it was clear like the expiration date had passed.
Well, it's because of Ice Cube. That's the thing. I remember specifically when Ice Cube left, Ice Cube. I was more into Ice Cube than I was into NWA. So when that first America's Most Wanted came out, because they recorded in New York with the Bomb Squad, Hank Shockley, that's what got me into Ice Cube, because the transition from Public Enemy to Ice Cube. And so I totally was Team Ice Cube when they broke up. And when Dr. Dre was rapping more clearly lyrically, they fell off and, you know, just didn't have the same, you know.
Yeah. But I remember getting the Ice Cube album and being super hyped for it because we were way into Public Enemy. We were way into NWA. And so it was like, I never got into that album that much.
What?
I just didn't.
Once upon a time in the projects, you had to wreck a hoe. You know, like, rats with your ass. On it,
and I liked some of the tracks. It's just that my level of anticipation was so high.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
That there was no way.
That makes sense. Whereas I did not have Straight Outta Compton. I didn't own any NWA stuff. You know, my first buying something was America's Most Wanted.
The other thing about Straight Outta Compton is it's a classic 80s cassette in that it's like David Bowie's big hit album where there's three killer songs to start the album and then it just falls off a cliff. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, Express Yourself and a couple other good songs on that, but there are tons of stinkers on Straight Outta Compton. And so we used to spend hours taking the best songs off Eazy-E, Straight Outta Compton, and the first DOC tape and making the ultimate, you know, five-star album. That
which Eazy-E songs did you like?
Boys in the Hood, man.
Oh, I thought you meant from a solo. You don't like any of those?
Yeah,
easier said than done.
Yeah. I mean, Eazy doesn't had a solid three good songs on it, or three great songs on it. And then the filler was really bad. And the DOC was good all the way through. That was what we always got stuck with because you needed a couple of DOC songs to round it out, but you could never pick, you know, what DSC songs would you pick?
But in the neighborhood that I was living at the time, you know, where I got my first house, you know, everybody was rolling through the neighborhood playing that stuff. And in true contrarian fashion, like I had it in the car, my 67 Chevy at the time, but I was just super obsessed with The Great Adventures of Slick Rick.
So
everybody is like, and I'm playing Back to Dating Sluts and Stars. You know, Slick Rick. Lottie Dottie, we like the party. You know, it was like, the fuck is that guy listening to? Yeah, baby, Slick Rick. So
We love the Slick Rick album too. But we'll come back and we'll talk about the LA riots and Dr. Dre's follow up with The Chronic.
Here's Schoolie D doing Saturday Night.
And I was feeling kind of sporty. Went to the bar, caught me a 40. Got kind of high and kind of drunk, so I
the ass of this little punk. Forgot my key, it had to ring my bell. My mama came down, she said, who the hell? Wait, mama, wait, it's me, your little son. Before I knew it, my mom pulled the gun.
And now a word from our sponsors. And here's Boys in the Hood from Eazy-E.
Cruising down the street in my 6'4". Jocking the slapping the went to the park to get the scoop. Knuckleheads out there, cold shooting some hoops. A car pulls up, who can it be? A fresh El Camino rolling Kilo G. He rolled down his window and he started to say, it's all about making that GTA. Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. You come talking that trash, we'll pull your car.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're returning to complete our episode about hip-hop evolution, episode 4. This is part 2 of that. Last time we talked about N.W.A. and the birth of gangster rap. And this time we're going to wrap it up with the L.A. riots and Dr. Dre's The Chronic.
What great timing.
Timing. It's everything.
It is. It is very, very apropos here in 2020. So after the big kerfluffles about fuck the police and N.W.A.'s, the rest of N.W.A.'s oeuvre in the late 80s, when the L.A. Rebellion hit the streets in 92 and the aftermath of the miscarriage of justice in the Rodney King case, when all four police officers, or was it seven or whatever, when the whole mob of killer cops was acquitted for the beating that anybody with eyes could see they had inflicted on Rodney King, and L.A. erupts in flames, that prompted a sea change in how N.W.A. was perceived. No longer were they seen as dangerous miscreants who were creating trouble out of whole cloth. Rather, they were seen as prophets and seers who were telling the story from the front lines. Did you guys have a similar shift, any kind of shift like that? Because I was just an NWA fan, and then I was appalled by the Rodney King thing, and it didn't really impact my thinking on it. You guys?
Well, when you say it didn't impact your thinking, that you're saying, in other words,
I already liked NWA, so.
Okay, but you're talking about the situation, so your awareness of it.
And in fact, I was less surprised by the Rodney King incident and the LA riots because I've been listening to N.W.A. So in a way, it had prepared, it had laid the groundwork for my
prep work.
But you know.
Well, I you know the thing is, if you were a punk rocker in California, I mean, my relationships with cops were pretty peaceful, or pretty mellow. New York cop in the late 70s, he didn't want any trouble, wasn't given any trouble. You know, he didn't want to write a report. He didn't want you to make him write a report. So it was pretty easy. I didn't start having problems with police until I got to California. And it was pretty unpleasant and pretty miserable. Worse so in L.A. I wrote a piece about hanging out with John Macias from Circle One, who was eventually shot in the head by a cop. A terrible story I'm not going to go into again here. But the reality of it was Richard Pryor had already talked about, hey, you know, white people don't think we're just making it up, you know. And I knew Daryl Gates, who had talked about chokeholds. Well, they work differently on black necks than they work on, you know. So I just, I the Rodney King didn't surprise me, but I was as surprised as anybody else on April 29th. I don't know enough about California, still don't. I mean, now because of infamy, I do, but I didn't know that the move, change of venue to Simi Valley meant anything, because I didn't realize it was a bedroom community for retired cops. It seemed like everybody else, I believe that these guys who were caught on video after video after showing of the video, 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 that it was open and shut case, and clearly, you know, abrogation of responsibility to uphold the law. And so it was shock and surprise. And it was sooner than the George Floyd thing. It was almost instantaneous. I mean, I think it was around 4 o'clock. I must have been at work.
But vis-a-vis NWA, how did it impact your thinking about NWA?
It was like some kid had run up to me screaming about a fire in a building. And then I look and I saw the fire in the building. It's like, you know, I've heard of such things. So I didn't see them as seers or prophets. I'd already known that California cops were bad news well before them, and mostly because of the whole punk rock thing and them just showing up to shows, beating people up indiscriminately. And these were like suburban white kids that they were beating up. They didn't beat me up, but, you know.
And Alexi?
That's the same thing. Well, you know, I wasn't a fan of NWA until – until I was maybe 10 plus years, 10, 15 years after they came out. I mean, I was always more of a conscious rapper fan. You know, I was into Public Enemy and groups like that that had something to say. Like, I was more into Ice-T than I was into NWA. I was more into Ice Cube after he left NWA than I was into NWA. And then, you know, especially with like Death Certificate, and like when he got more political. So for me, NWA had kind of been appropriated already by white suburban teenagers. When NWA came out, my family had moved to, and we still kept the house in DC. My parents were renting it out. And because they knew that once the subway came, they knew the plans for the neighborhood. It was a historic house. They bought in the winter, you know, learned the hard way how the neighborhood changed. But they knew there were plans to expand the subway line. So we stayed in there until drug needles in our lawn. I didn't go to school in the neighborhood. My parents, you know, knew how to work it so that my brothers and I didn't get affected by what was going on. So they kept the house. Went out to Maryland, and NWA was more Columbia, Maryland, which is like, you know, probably white environment, the Utopia City, which turned out to be a company town, you know, NSA town, before people knew what NSA was. We didn't realize until we went out there. But, you know, the white kids out there were listening to NWA. You know, so anytime like the police would show up, they'd say, and we were like, fuck the police. We all chanting, and it's so cool. You know, so for me, that, you know, and the, you know, it didn't resonate with me as, oh, they're prophetic. It isn't until years later I was like, okay, now I understand what they were talking about at the time. But, you know, in terms of the cops, you heard stuff. I mean, growing up in a probably black city, going to Howard University, you know, you heard enough stuff. You hear enough stories coming from people from California and what was going on with the police, so that, you know, it wasn't anybody that opened my eyes to it. And when the cops were found not guilty, it wasn't a surprise also. You know, it was disappointing. It wasn't a surprise because, you know, again, in DC at Howard University, we know anything about history, you're accustomed to justice not being served. And also in Washington, DC, I was there when Marion Barry was mayor, and you literally saw this motherfucker smoking crack. And, you know, you have a situation where he didn't get the sentence everyone thought he was going to get, you know, so.
In his defense, the bitch set him up.
Yeah, goddamn. I saw the tape, man. Goddamn bitch set him up.
No, I was surprised by the verdict. I thought it was an open and shut case. But, you know, California justice was still, and a lot of the police reforms, it a hard place to get a job as a cop in California. I know people come from Philly who tried to become cops in California. They don't meet the standards. And a lot of those changes were put in post 1992. So,
yeah. So let's turn now to the follow-up to the post-riot follow-up by Dr. Dre. So NWA splinters, Ruthless Record, first Ice Cube leaves, yeah, like we talked about last time, the main lyricist of the group. And NWA soldiers on very successfully in a commercial sense. Their follow-up albums, because of SoundScan, I think their second album debuted at number one. Or moved to number one after not being a number. The week SoundScan happened, boom, NWA was number one. But then they fall apart because Dre and everybody figures out that Easy and Jerry Heller at Ruthless are allegedly ripping them off. And Suge Knight lures Dr. Dre away. Dre is the musical talent behind NWA, just like Ice Cube was the lyrical talent behind NWA. And Death Row Records is put together by Suge Knight. And Dre lays out a whole new blueprint for rap. I mean, they call it in the show an album that would reshape the future of hip-hop and American popular culture. And on the hip-hop front, it's because he stopped using samples and got a live band in there, and they would frequently be recreating parts they heard on old records. But that's as old as recorded music. I mean, you know, if you listen to any blues record or R&B, any record, really, they learned most of the licks from somebody else, you know?
Yeah, but I think he kicked back a lot to George Clinton because some of that stuff on the – yeah, okay. So that's – yeah, he did the right thing by Clinton, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is that
Roger Troutman.
Yeah, it was a twofold evolution. One, away from samples, and it was because they had to, because Biz Markie and De La Soul had been sued, and the courts were clearly not sympathetic at all to rappers that are sampling.
Yep.
And it was also an evolution, just a natural evolution, as a new wave of musical people come along James Brown was no longer the primary influence. You had a new wave of artists who grew up on P-Funk in the late 70s instead of James Brown in the early 70s, and synthesizers and all the different things that came along in the late 70s. Now Dre had synthesizers and could play with them, and you know, but he also had a jazz bass player in there, and so it's a big sea change. And then the secondary thing is the immense popularity of the Chronic when it drops. I mean, it was on. I mean, NWA debuted at number one, but the Chronic went, I think, triple platinum in a year, and ultimately went like quadruple or quintuple platinum. And Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, who was basically the lead rapper on the Chronic. I mean, it could have been a Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg album. Snoop Dogg becomes a superstar, and I mean, at a whole nother level than NWA had ever reached. And that's the weird thing to me is, like, I didn't like the Chronic because I didn't like the change in the samples. And I also had lost interest in NWA when they got so crude and violent. When they lost Ice Cube, the poetry was gone.
Yeah, it was evil snagging you're talking about.
Yeah, and it was just sort of this ugliness. And the Chronic, I think, going back, I recognize that I was way off on the Chronic. Like, this is a really good album. This is a classic pop album, a classic hip hop album, a classic R&B album. But at the time, I was put off by the music and the vibe. And I think they talked about this. Like, they've got the Arabian Prince talking about going to the studio when Dre was working on this, and he didn't know anybody, and he was scared of the people that were surrounding Suge Knight, including Snoop Dogg.
You know, the thing is,
at the time,
you know,
go ahead.
No, well, the thing is, when you talk about the vibe, I think it's something, I don't know if we discussed it last time. I don't think we did. I remember my parents, you know, they're public school teachers, high school teachers. My mother taught Eastern High School in Washington, D.C., East Capitol Street, which when they were talking about, like, Stand By Me and Joe Clark, Ralph Neal, who was the principal at the time, Eastern High School, was kind of like a corollary of that, right? So in terms of taking a rough school and disciplinary and turning it around. And the thing that – one of the reasons why I couldn't really get into NWA – it's funny, although I got into Ice Cube, and you talk about the vibe, right, of NWA – that's problematic was, I remember my parents talking about their frustration with the misogyny that was ramping up, that they blamed it on the music, right? Yep. And I was like, oh, no, you're just talking. I was like, no, Alex, you don't understand. Like, you have to understand, back in the day, being ghetto was nothing that you aspired to. If you look at, like, Motown, like, they would take kids that were rough and street and teach them how to be civilized and disciplined, and the precision of the dance moves and the aspirations to escape your certain environment, which is kind of tying into the Showstopper, Eugene, that you talk about. This was phenomenal. Baby. People have to definitely listen to. And so it was that. And then they said also, like, you know, referring to women as bitches and whores, like, that they said, we've never heard so many students become comfortable with that kind of terminology. And I was like, ah, you know, I was like, no, Alexi, you seriously never have heard it. And so as time went on, I started to notice it as well. Like, it was this, again, not saying misogyny wasn't there, but there was a certain kind of, like, people trying to emulate what they were listening to. And so that's one of the reasons why, when you talk about the Chronic, I wasn't feeling NWA. I was more of into Public Enemy. I got into Ice Cube when he left NWA. And then when the Chronic came around, again, it would seem so steeped within that misogynistic culture, even the videos and everything. I was like, I just was not. So I thought it was funny when you said that at the time you weren't feeling the Chronic. I wasn't either. I was like, there's certain songs that was all right, and I like Snoop Dogg's flow, but I just was not feeling that record.
Influence, by the way,
what do you say?
Which is very Slick Rick influence. I noticed that today, going back, because I've been listening to this first Snoop Dogg album and the Chronic a lot, getting ready for this, and there's a spot on, I think, the Snoop Dogg album where he's clearly quoting Slick Rick, like
yeah, the flow. Yeah, and he comes out and he references it, and he says, you know, if you're not down with it, you can, you know, blow me. I think is it fundamentally what he says, you know.
And on Doggy Style, he covered
Lottie Dottie,
right?
Yeah,
he covered it on purpose. He claimed because to get, he's like, look, if white artists, I remember this back in the day. I mean, it was on Doggy Style. It wasn't on, you know, it wasn't on the Chronic, where he said that, look, white people cover white song, rock songs, so the original artists get paid. I'm covering songs I like because I want artists that rappers that I like to get paid, and I want to introduce their music. I mean, that's what he claimed.
And I think that's a good thing. But I want to say one thing about the pimp culture that really comes from Iceberg Slim in the 60s and 70s, you know, the first pimp that published his memoirs.
Yep.
And they're brilliant, brilliantly written books, but I'd compare them with like Carl Panzram or some other. Those Iceberg Slim books about pimping are the most horrifying true crime books I've ever read, because he really captures the vicious psychological abuse and the constant power struggle that goes on between a pimp and his, you know,
and his hoes.
Yeah, but you know, Ice-T and Ice Cube both got their handles from Iceberg
Slim. But Ice Cube and in Who's the Mac, he says, and this is what one of the things that endeared me to him, he said, unlike Iceberg Slim and some of them be claiming P-I-M-P, no, I ain't going out that way. I'm just a straight up N-I-double-G-A. So his whole thing was trying to take himself apart from a certain kind later. Of aspect of the culture and say, like, I'm just straight up. Like, I'm not trying to act like I'm a pimp. But then years later, he sold out. It was a good day by saying, like, and a New Year blimp said, Goodyear blimp said, Ice Cube's a pimp. I was like, dude, you just sold out.
Well, I don't know.
But to go back, when you talk about when they started Death Row, you also remember there was a famous case. I mean, we now know Snoop as the guy who hangs out with Martha Stewart, but there was the murder case, right?
Yeah.
And there was a strong possibility that he was going to go to jail for murder.
That's right.
And he made a song about it in full Slick Rick fashion. Murder was the case, right?
Yeah, so, and he was a full-on Crip. And that was one of the reasons, you know, I said, you know, the Arabian Prince was scared of him too, because he was a crook and a hoodlum. And
well, Dr. Dre beat up D Barnes too before the Chronic, right? Remember Tim Dog, who I was supporting from New York, you know, beating on D from Pump It Up. Fuck with the dog, get fucked up.
Yeah.
Well, but, no, it was Dr. Dre who beat
Dr. Dre. Is that what I said when I say Snoop Dogg? Yeah, Dr. Dre.
You said Tim Dog.
No, Tim Dog was a rapper who came out against him for it.
Yeah, and but the other
For reasons that were never entirely clear to me, actually. So,
that's probably unknowable at this point. But the other cultural figures that were bringing that pimping vibe in was Rudy Ray Moore and other comedians.
Dolemite.
Were playing with the pimp iconography and
comedians.
Well,
right, because I like Dolemite. I like Dolemite. I could fuck with Dolemite, but I could not fuck with the rapper pimps.
Well, because it was serious, and I think that the ensuing career of Suge Knight shows that this was an ominous development. Mm. That there were true bad apples in the barrel there, and a lot of people suffered. You know, and I mean, there's still rumors that they deliberately infected Eazy-E with the HIV. I mean, and given what happened to Biggie and Tupac. And the speculation around that, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to say that it's impossible that Eazy-E got AIDS the traditional way, but I also don't think it's impossible that Suge Knight put a hit on him, you know, like.
Well, you know, he played football down in Compton, and a woman who is now a pretty esteemed lawyer, her brother, she's from Compton, her brother played football with him, and, you know, in private conversations with me, she's never had any good things to say about Suge, and this was even before all the bad stuff had come out. So, you know, it wasn't surprising to me when Dr. Dre finally pulled away, and his explanation rang really true as well. And he said, you know, sometimes you go to a party, I think this is almost a direct quote, and you're not enjoying being at the party, so what do? You leave. So
yeah, well said. And there's a couple other quotes I want to get in there though that I thought was interesting. The Corrupt had a quote that the Chronic was not just about what was going on, which is what NWA had been. The Chronic was about how we felt about what was going on. And Ice Cube threw in, you know, you could feel how dangerous the times are in that record. And there is a sonic sinisterness to that record that NWA, for all its sonic power and violence, did not have. Yep. I mean, the Chronic has a bad vibe to it that's more ominous and creepy than that's what NWA true. Had.
But it was also, I mean, it was also post Rodney King.
Yeah.
Right. And much like West Coast hip hop, it was also car movie music. Mm. So both the car music and that being the nexus point by which many people experienced bad coppery. Yeah, I think these all contributed to, you know, a mise-en-scene where it was just, yeah, it was symphonic.
The cars that go boom.
SAT word.
Yeah. Remember that one, Eugene?
No. I'm thinking more of the day the niggas took over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, and I also think, though, and the last point Cube had was it was more about you can still have fun no matter what obstacles you're facing. And that's an important thing to remember about The Chronic and Snoop Dogg's first album is it's catchy as shit. Right. I mean, you know, there
are... And the videos, let's not understate the videos. This is when MTV, before they started, made it reality TV. Those videos were actually fantastic. I mean, it was the first time. When I got to California, all I knew about Lowriders were that it was a song by War. Mm. That's it. I didn't know the whole culture. And that was the first, like, blast of, you know, 62 Chevy Impala with hydraulics back to back and front to side. I didn't know what the hell that was until I got to California. And it was, you know, I mean, a lot of the cats I know from New York who moved out west are deep into that because it's like another kind of outlaw subculture, and that was very much a part of it too.
And it was also that's how kids were listening to music back in the 90s was in their cars.
Still,
kids don't drive cars like they used to.
Bro, I live in a low income.
Still, the majority of
and their cars are going.
I see your kids in Texas, and I raise you kids in California. Come to my hood, Nate. No,
this is a.
I don't know
a quantitative
single, I don't
house.
Know what, I
driving
know
rates for kids
kid.
Are way down. Way down across the
country.
I'm
going to do the next show from outside by the stop sign in front of my house.
I'm not saying all kids are driving cars. I'm just saying we are the lowest rates of teens are waiting later and later to get their driver's license. Fewer and fewer teens in 20s own cars. Fewer and fewer teens are driving cars. I mean, that car culture thing, I'm sure is still clinging on in certain laggard areas such as your neighborhood.
No, I'm going to tell you, like, my very angry college freshman roommate said when I was like, what's the big deal about not having a car? You know, because in high school, if I wanted to go on a date, I just got on the subway.
Right.
He goes, try getting on a bus to take a date out in California.
Again,
you don't do
millennials
it.
And Zoomers are not even dating in the sense that we did.
Oh, fuck. God.
No, they're not hookup culture, and they're hanging out in groups. This is quantified social science. And plus the kids that I know. Kids
did you not hear this show stop when Eugene was talking about how weird the Negroes were in California?
We're sucking into some bullshit. But the reality was
I don't
in
really
the
have
90s,
teenage kids, that's all.
Yeah.
Whatever. Far fewer kids are driving now than were driving in the 90s. In the 90s, they were all driving, except in a few urban areas like New York, where they had subway systems. But otherwise, the nation was a car culture.
But don't you think there could be a difference, though, between with the nation and California? Because California, it's so steeped as a car culture, right?
Yeah.
I think California could be a laggard in that aspect. But
yeah,
you know,
my kid purposefully got four bicycles stolen so that she didn't have to bike to school. Four good bikes.
He's like, wait a second, stolen. My kid, and they're only how old? Got one stolen. Watch out, Nate.
Yeah.
We are watching for the bikes to disappear off the porch at all times. But the point I was wanting to make is in the 90s, most of the nation's kids were in cars and listening to music. And I think, you know, when you pointed out the other week that EPMD was a car band, that I think that helped them get big nationally. But the one line I want to get another quote in was the LL Cool J. It really blew the doors off the suburbs. It's like Dre said, I want to make a record for the projects, period. And then like every suburban kid in the world had their face in the window. And that was so true. He didn't modify at all what he was saying. He didn't clean it up for the white kids. And that was kind of the genius of NWA in the first place, was kind of make it a little more cartoony. Let's make the hood a product and a fantasy land, you know. And I think, like, to Alexi's point, you know, that was what put your parents off of it. And I think it put me off it to some extent, but it was a big part of the overall vibe of the 90s, which I think we can look back and say was a pretty amoral vibe. You know, it's the Clinton era. It's about making money and a little bit less racist than the 80s, but still, you know, grunge blows up, hip hop blows up, and the heroin that came with the grunge and the heroin chic and the gangster chic that came with the hip hop came too.
Crack.
Crack was an 80s thing, you know?
But actually making crack enterprises was people, I was shocked to discover in my low-income neighborhood, the house that was across the street from me, you know, which was like a crack distribution point. The cops busted them one time when I lived there. And I read the newspaper that they had coffee cans stocked full of $80,000 here and $80,000 there. That was serious Damn. Money for me in 1991. That
Wait,
was
you said serious money. Money for you?
Serious money for me.
I heard of these coffee cans.
No. maybe that was peanuts for them. But for me, in my perception, I was like, oh, shit, Bob has got 80 grand in coffee. I'm going to rob Bob, you know? But it was crack as an institution. And I think that's important because then ultimately that would set the scene for you understanding some of the choices that 50 Cent made later on, right?
Mm. Well, absolutely. But the point I wanted to make was that the ominous vibe of the Chronic sets the tone for the rest of the 90s. Like I would say the 90s kind of begin with the Chronic, and that, you know, the true 90s don't start until 93 when the Chronic drops, and that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the decade, which goes on until 9/11 hits. You know, the long 90s or whatever, or I guess it was the short 90s. But anyway, that's pretty much all the points I wanted to hit. Although I got to go back to this car thing, Eugene. Kids don't drive as much as they used to. They do not.
I do not know a single kid, and I know lots of them because I have a 17-year-old. 17.
Yeah, I get that kids in California are driving, but you know, anecdote is not data, and the data is
bro, you can't walk anywhere here.
I know that. But the rest of the country is.
Oh yeah, okay. Rest of the country.
You coastal elite.
Rest of the country. But even in places
how dare you?
Even in places like Houston that are just as sprawling, teen drivers is way down. Even in California, teen driving numbers are down. Kids are waiting longer to get their license.
You're gonna have to send me a link on that one.
I'll send you.
Sounds like a challenge.
But all of this is well off topic, and
but what would a show be with the three of us without it going well off topic?
Exactly.
Hold on. Now I'm ashamed that I don't know this, and I can't think of it, and it's kind of blowing my mind. What was Dr. Dre's follow-on record to The Chronic?
Took him years and years to put out.
I know.
Chronic 2001 or something.
What was it?
Doggy Style, Snoop Dogg. His Dr. Dre's was like The Chronic, like 2000 or something. But the record right after that, Doggy Style, was kind of like
the follow-on. I'm at Dr. Dre's.
So that's what like Chronic 2000 or Chronic 2000.
2000, and it was long after the point.
Yes. But was it on Aftermath or was it on Death Row?
It was not on Death Row. He was long gone from Death Row.
Yeah, okay. So it was on the label he started called Aftermath.
Can't do math.
Something like that. Yeah, but that's all. All that's off topic. But
Nate is regulating, and we're not even talking about the Warren G era.
Yeah, I'm gonna do a show here. The follow up was Snoop Dogg. And Doggy Style, that was the follow up to The Chronic, produced by Dre, featuring Snoop Dogg. I mean, the whole gang was
he was producing the videos, which made them suck.
Yeah, you know, but you know, that one by one, they all drift away from Death Row Records because it was shit. But the last one I wanted to get to was, what was your response, or when did you realize how big The Chronic and hip hop had gotten? Because, you know, it was on beyond. Oh wow, suburban white kids are into this and it's really popular. But it was, holy shit, this is the most popular thing. Like it was 2 or 3 years later, I realized, I guess it was probably when Biggie Smalls came out and Puff Daddy came out, and I realized this is pop. This has taken the place of pop music in the culture. This is the most popular style of music, bar none. When did you guys figure that out?
Pretty soon, man, because it was like a bomb. It was a 360 degree thing. All of a sudden, people who hadn't worn Pendletons were wearing Pendletons. People who hadn't worn khakis were wearing khakis. All of a sudden, people in New York City were claiming sets that they had never ever talked about. I mean, if you remember New York gangs from 70s and 80s, you know, it was Jolly Stompers, the Latin Kings. It was like, not then all of a sudden people are Bloods and Crips in New York City. It changed everything. The video with Snoop walking through the city, stomping on buildings. It was a major tectonic shift back east and in California, you know, cars. You know, I couldn't find parts for my 67 Chevy. Impossible. I had to like send away to other states to get like stuff like bumpers, because car culture, Japanese cats were coming here buying American cars and trying to have them shipped. It was crazy. It was, from a point of view of like a guy who was in music, to see how many units and how it was pretty phenomenal. You got to remember, this is when you could still make money on music, you know, before Napster and all that kind of stuff. It was gigantic.
And I was
envious.
For me, you know, I was in D.C. at that time, and the Chronic was out. I was back in D.C., you know, going to Howard. So go-go music was still going strong. So in terms of seeing a shift, I mean, go-go hadn't lost a step. So, you know, I wasn't watching rap music and saying, oh, this is like the big pop music now. I mean, it had been the big pop music like in the late 80s, you know, mid to late 80s, like, you know, in the
Trouble
suburbs.
Funk.
Trouble Funk, that's right. And RARESSENCE, yeah. Rare Essence. And Chuck Brown and Soul Searchers.
That's right. Right.
Yes, yes. And we can address why go-go never broke out nationally on another day.
Oh, there we go.
I think it was a live music. And then, yes. And then also, too, one of the things that you kind of touched on before that I think that you can't really be understated was about how incredibly violent that time was.
Yep.
I mean, you know, that was part of the Pendletons and the, yep, the 60s muscle cars. And it was, you know,
people getting,
I mean,
shot up at house party, college house parties, and people, yeah, getting pistol, yeah, whipped in dorms and shit. Like, it was.
Yeah. Yeah. People were like living. I mean, it was like, okay, you had a few mafia cats like John Gotti who were seeing The Godfather a few too many times and start wearing expensive suits. When, you know, Sicilian mafia would be like, what the hell? Tracksuit's fine for me. But this really permeated the culture. And it was, I mean, you know, the city that I'm living in now, East Palo Alto, had been the murder capital of America during that time period. It was largely fueled by, I think, this kind of mimicry of this mimetic desire that people had for making the music part of their lives. It was really pretty. And I want to use a word like descriptive, like horrible or depressing.
Corrosive
is a good word.
Yes. So that's a wrap for our discussion of the first season of Hip Hop Evolution. And we'll be back to talk about season two next week.
Nate, Alexi, and Eugene will be back next week with a discussion of Season 2, Episode 1 of Hip Hop Evolution, The Southern Way, which takes our tale to Florida and Texas and introduces the two live crew, the Ghetto Boys and UGK.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.